This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. Written and read by me, Dan Crenshaw. This book is for my mom, who taught me true grace and fortitude in the face of suffering, and to my wife, Tara, who taught me love, loyalty, and strength. I would not be here without you. Introduction. Stay outraged. I left my Washington, D.C. office in the Cannon Building to go vote on the House floor of the Capitol, as I usually do multiple times a day while Congress is in session. It was spring of 2019, and I had just been sworn into my first term a few months prior. It was sunny outside, barely above 70 degrees, the air pleasant and crisp, so I avoided the underground tunnels that connect the Capitol to the congressional offices and crossed Independence Avenue above ground instead. It's a far more enjoyable experience to walk toward the Capitol, with its majestic dome in full view, and hard not to be awestruck by the experience of entering the beating heart of our republic. You never know who you will run into during that five-minute walk. Capitol Hill is teeming with journalists, activists, and tourists, most of whom are rather pleasant most of the time. That particular day, I noticed a group of protesters outside the Capitol. This was not an unusual scene. Activists often gather at the steps of the Capitol. It is the people's house, after all. But this was an unusual group of protesters, because it wasn't clear what they were protesting for. There were no calls for the passage of a particular bill or attention to a certain issue. Instead, they wore shirts that simply read, "Stay Outraged," along with a matching assortment of signs and buttons that appeared to be professionally crafted from an established vendor, not purchased hastily from some ragtag print shop. I was puzzled. I wondered about the meaning of their slogan, "Stay Outraged." Why this phrase? Why not instead rally around a slogan that more accurately depicted what they protested or advocated for? Assuming there was one. What drew these young people to the slogan and, more importantly, to the notion that staying outraged was the desired end goal? Perhaps I was simply too unenlightened to understand the value of perpetual outrage? Perhaps, but unlikely. It was more likely that this small group of activists was born of a larger cultural paradigm, one that has permeated our media and national discourse as of late. It was far more likely that the antagonistic headlines of the last few years had finally succeeded in manipulating the behaviors and emotions of our citizens and directed these activists to the steps of the Capitol to encourage others along the same path of indignation and everlasting anger. This aimless rage was deliberately designed, intended to produce this exact result. "It's important to stay outraged," implored the title of a 2019 op-ed, in the hopes that their readers would not fall back into the complacency of their cheerful daily routines. "Get outraged and stay outraged," exclaimed another headline, equally desperate for sustained irritation. "Never lose your sense of outrage," tweeted Senator Bernie Sanders, knowing the most effective political manipulation is achieved by raw emotion. One recent op-ed acknowledged the psychological tax of outrage, giving more in-depth advice. How to hashtag stay outraged without losing your mind. Self-care lessons for the resistance. Outrage is in vogue, they proclaim, and more than that, it is a necessity. But this story of unrelenting ire goes far beyond the abstract sloganeering of politicians and media. Stay outraged is also sprawled on countless t-shirts and stickers and buttons for sale across the internet, as these young activists had clearly discovered. It's a peculiar thought, this notion that if only you were sufficiently informed, aware, and woke, that you would have a duty to exhibit an intense state of fury. The apocalyptic nature of our unjust reality must surely enrage you. It must. Not only that, but once you've achieved an enlightened state of madness, then you must stay that way, perhaps forever. Now, being a normal person with normal concerns, you may read those headlines with healthy skepticism, if not outright confusion. Don't we live in the most prosperous nation on earth, with a quality of life and freedoms that are the envy of the world? But, respond the outraged, this is just proof you aren't paying attention. If you only knew the true depths of disaster, despair, and injustice in our midst, you'd rush to join the mob in righteous cultural warfare, scream slogans in solidarity, and march arm in arm to cancel those who disobey, destroy the careers of those who misspeak, and pile on those who dare to defend anything other than outrage orthodoxy. A peculiar thought indeed. Let me suggest an alternative. Outrage is weakness. It is the muting of rational thinking and the triumph of emotion. Despite what you've been hearing and seeing as of late, it is not a virtue. It is not something to be celebrated, nor praised, nor aspired to. It is a deeply human emotion, even understandable at times, but rarely is it productive, virtuous, or useful. It is an emotion to overcome, not accept, and overcoming it requires mental strength. This book is about acquiring that necessary mental fortitude. Let's define our terms. What do I mean by outrage? It is a specific term with a specific meaning. Not all forms of outrage are always unjustified, far from it. There is such a thing as righteous indignation. This book is not about proper outrage, stemming from real tragedy or wrongdoing or injustice. This is not a book about overcoming true grief. It is about outrage culture and the newfound tendency to reflexively assume the worst of intentions when reacting to news or commentary or political discourse, and default into an emotionally driven hatred of the other, whoever that may be. It is the petty, weak-minded, and ultimately unproductive response to our neighbors, fellow citizens, and political opponents that has been normalized and even elevated in our culture. It is about the hypersensitivity that has infected our society, where undesirable language is the equivalent of physical violence, or an old tweet or Facebook post can be grounds for ruination and public shame, and where an absence of reason or fact encourages public indictment, moral outrage, and mob rule. Outrage culture is the weaponization of emotion and the elevation of emotion above reason. It is the new normal, where moral righteousness rises in proportion to your level of outrage. The more outraged one is, the more authentic one is perceived to be. And the more authentic one is, the greater one's moral standing, reason, rationale, and evidence be damned. My debut in the public eye was premised on an avoidance of outrage culture, a rare thing these days, when I was publicly expected to take Saturday Night Live and Pete Davidson to task for wronging me with an offensive joke. I didn't. More on that later. For now, it suffices to say that mere words could not hurt me, a statement that is becoming less and less prevalent or even desirable to many these days. It was my first personal encounter with modern-day outrage culture, but I am certainly not the first to notice this new and troubling trend. Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff dissect this new phenomenon in The Coddling of the American Mind. Focusing on college students in particular, the authors find that a culture of safetyism has become widespread, wherein students actually feel that opposing views are a literal danger to their physical well-being. The mantra of sticks and stones is being turned on its head. This false sense of danger leads to extreme reactions to that perceived danger. Students and activists feel justified shouting down others, vandalizing property, and even assaulting political opponents. This sort of emotional reasoning has been promoted instead of discouraged, leading students to see microaggressions everywhere they look. Instead of seeking understanding, people are increasingly interpreting the actions of others in the least generous way possible and assuming the worst of intentions. While Haidt and Lukianoff write about this phenomenon in terms of recent history and the modern terminology that accompanies it, it is not entirely new. I first encountered irrational microaggression interpretations when I was in the third grade, growing up in Katy, Texas, just outside of Houston. We were discussing food chains in class, a fairly simple subject for a third grader. Big animals eat small animals. Small animals eat plants or insects. But being a kid, this explanation was not really sufficient to hold my attention. I built out my own explanation of food chains, using the reality and experiences around me. After all, you master a subject faster if you put it into your own words. And so I went on to describe food chains in the context of our classroom. I pointed to my classmates, one by one, and said, John ate Lindsay, Merrill ate John, and so on. And then I ended my lecture with the final apex predator in my food chain, my teacher. For the sake of anonymity, I'll call her Miss Smith. I said, in perfect earshot of said apex predator, that Miss Smith ate Merrill. It did not go over well. My teacher, Miss Smith, was unable to imagine the audacity of a 9-year-old suggesting she might eat a student, even in the context of discussing food chains. It was clear that she thought I was referencing her weight, despite the fact that I had listed everyone in the class as part of my food chain exercise. She was decidedly outraged, lacking in facts and context with which to address the situation, and unable to assume anything but the most malevolent of intentions. She dragged me to the vice principal's office, my classmates looking on in terror as I left the classroom. Shame, shame, they must have thought. Merrill was in shock, but perhaps he was also relieved that Miss Smith had no intention of eating him. Into the VP's office we went, where a serious woman sat and listened intently as a flustered Miss Smith explained the extent of my misdeeds. The red-haired professional administrator gave no indication that she thought this was a frivolous accusation. In fact, as she nodded along to Miss Smith's frantic story, she brought out a book to show me. In it were the disciplinary codes and potential punishments for profanity. I had not learned this word, profanity, yet, and given my vocabulary disadvantage, I was in no position to argue. This is where the whole episode really went off the rails. The VP pointed to a section where it said that law enforcement could be called in serious cases of profanity. They were dead serious. They were threatening to call the police on a 9-year-old for saying Miss Smith ate Merrill. I was scared to death as they discussed going easier on me with mere in-school suspension. My mom was eventually called into the office to be informed that I would be punished with in-school suspension. She was terminally ill with cancer and would pass away a year later. We had real struggles, not perceived ones. Life and death circumstances, not microaggressions. She was undergoing another round of chemotherapy, and she couldn't care less about the hypersensitive, outrage-prone Miss Smith. At home, I was not in trouble. We had more important things to worry about. Since that day in 1993, things have only gotten worse. It is anyone's guess as to why. Many other authors have examined this trend. But I think the internet, social media, and transformed incentives within mainstream media reporting are a good place to start. What used to be rare instances of political correctness, microaggressions, and irrational anger have metastasized into the outrage culture we see today, characterized not just by outrage and political correctness, but also by identity politics and an increasingly polarizing media and digital environment. Haidt and Lukianoff note, quote, common enemy identity politics, when combined with microaggression theory, produces a call-out culture in which almost anything one says or does could result in public shaming, end quote. Add in the element of anonymization inherent in social media comments, and you have the ingredients for a toxic mob politics culture. This mob, unshackled by the interpersonal limitations of good manners, won't even let progressive leaders like President Barack Obama off the hook. The New York Times opinion section pounced on the former president after he made this all-too-sensible observation on cancel culture. Quote, I can sit and feel pretty good about myself because, man, you see how woke I was. I called you out. That's not activism. That's not bringing about change. If all you're doing is casting stones, you're probably not going to get that far. That's easy to do. End quote. The young columnist at the Times dismissed Obama as an out-of-touch boomer for his comments. It was a foolish, emotional reaction to sensible remarks by the former president. It isn't just millennials and Gen Z, of course. The entire U.S. political system seems to be infected by these problematic cultural trends, cheered on by our media and opinion journalists who thrive on drama, conflict, and strife. Knowing that the most salacious headlines will get the most clicks, journalists are all too happy to oblige. As Jeffrey Berry and Sarah Soberai of Tufts University note in The Outrage Industry, headlines and commentary are deliberately misleading and infused with outrage speech, designed not for substance, but for emotional response. In Hate, Inc., Matt Taibbi notes that this is partly because the financial incentives for incendiary opinion journalism are so strong. Quote, "There is a financial pull toward research-free stories. Writing 1,200 words of jokes about a Trump tweet costs less than sending a reporter undercover into a Mexican maquiladora." End quote. It has grown terribly difficult to separate objective journalism from opinion journalism. Back in the days when evening news anchor Walter Cronkite was considered the most trusted man in America, there was a well-defined separation between news and opinion. Today, they have bled into each other. This exacerbates division and resentment. Whereas we have long understood that Fox News leans right and MSNBC leans left, the rest of the news networks still try to pass themselves off as objective nonpartisans. This frustrates conservatives the most, since networks like CNN still proclaim to be just the facts, or news analysis, when in fact most hosts persistently engage in left-leaning opinion journalism. It is no wonder that trust in mass media has been edging lower and lower over the past 20 years, down to 41% in September 2019, according to Gallup. This has deeper consequences than just heightened societal tensions. These problematic cultural trends and misleading media practices are changing the actual values that we deem good. Our culture has come to view heroes, the figures or attributes that we should emulate, differently. And that's a problem. A classic view of the hero archetype would be a person who is calm, collected, and self-assured. A person raised on the mantra of sticks and stones, or the great Rudyard Kipling line, "If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you." Of course, few people have an honest claim to such virtue. We are all prone to overreaction and emotional reasoning. But the point is that we strive to be better. We want to be that hero, the one who has a cool head, a calm soul, and a sharp tongue. It seems that that archetype has lost standing to its own antithesis, righteous outrage, emotional reaction, and moral grandstanding. The new hero is the one who speaks truth to power, a tired cliche with an elusive definition, and signals their oppression loudly, ready to bravely point out how others have wronged them. Where the bravery is in this scenario is lost on me, but people believe it nonetheless. It's an indication that certain versions of heroic attributes, like being brave and outspoken, are still valued, though their meaning has been twisted to accommodate what is clearly a victimhood mentality. And why not? In this day and age, victimhood is power. That is the setup for this book. As a society, we may have finally reached a point where we realize something is a little off. The pathos has grown out of control, often at the expense of logic, decency, and virtue. We aren't acting the way we are supposed to. We mock virtue without considering how its abandonment accelerates our moral decay. We aren't acting as a culture that is mature or enlightened or educated. We aren't acting worthy of this beautiful country and political system that we inherited from our revolutionary ancestors. Rather, we don a mantle of fragility, of anger, of childishness, and are utterly shameless in doing so. The consequences of this decay are many, but ultimately, it's a question of sustainability. How long can our society endure when we are at each other's throats? We don't want to know the answer to that question. We want to know how to fix it. These lessons will make you mentally stronger, better equipped to face life's challenges, and as impervious as possible to the outrage culture all around us. The basic message is this: if you're losing your cool, you are losing. If you are triggered, it is because you allowed someone else to dictate your emotional state. If you are outraged, it is because you lack discipline and self-control. These are personal defeats, not the fault of anyone else. And each defeat shapes who you are as a person, and in the collective sense, who we are as a people. This book is about actively hardening your mind so that you can be the person you think you should be. It is about identifying who that person is in the first place and taking responsibility for the self-improvement required to become them. It is about learning what it means to never quit. It is about learning to take a joke and giving others some charity when they make a bad one. It is about the importance of building a society of iron-tough individuals who can think for themselves, take care of themselves, and recognize that a culture characterized by grit, discipline, and self-reliance is a culture that survives. A culture characterized by self-pity, indulgence, outrage, and resentment is a culture that falls apart. It really is that simple, and it is a truly existential choice. We must make that choice, and it must be a choice to be more disciplined, mentally tougher, and convinced of the fact that we control our own destiny. The next chapter of our American story depends on it. Chapter 1. Perspective from Darkness. The bomb, a homemade fertilizer-based compound wrapped in plastic, was mere feet away, buried about a foot below the hard surface. A rudimentary pressure plate, two panels of wood and some wire and a battery, was all it needed to detonate right in my face. We Americans spend millions of dollars trying to blow up our enemies. Smart bombs aren't cheap, and national security is an expensive pursuit. The Taliban spent about $10, including the cost of labor and medical benefits. Note to fact checkers, this is a joke. Taliban don't actually have health insurance. The blast felt like a truck hitting me head on, and in the truck were a dozen angry men with shotguns, all shooting at me simultaneously. My world went dark. I suffered through the pain for about 45 minutes until I got myself up and walked to the helicopter, able to hear the soothing rattle of the Mark 46 machine guns laying down cover fire around me. But I could not see them. When I slipped into unconsciousness on the medevac helicopter, I was in Afghanistan. When I woke up, I was in Germany. Getting blown up by an IED and enduring what came after was not an experience I am eager to repeat. But that day in Afghanistan was something I had come to expect. I had sought leadership and combat from an early age, most SEALs do, and I knew death and wounds were possibilities. They were what we signed up for. Hell, I had known it ever since my dad gave me a copy of Dick Marcinko's first book, Rogue Warrior. "Read this," he said. "Sure, whatever," I said. I was only 13 and therefore incapable of showing excitement to a parent, but secretly, I was psyched. Rogue Warrior, a gritty, rough-hewn, half-true book series written by the founder of SEAL Team 6, is not fine literature, but it might as well have been Hemingway and Shakespeare combined for a kid seeking adventure and glory. I hadn't just found an entertaining book about the SEAL teams. I had found my purpose. At that young age, I decided I was going to become a Navy SEAL. I was going to join the teams and relish in the risk-taking bravado that made these guys superhuman. But here's the thing. Romanticized, hypothetical thrill-seeking eventually becomes pretty damn real. On that fateful 2012 deployment, we found ways to deal with the threat of injury and death. For one, we painstakingly planned our missions so as to mitigate risk. Just as importantly, we used humor to dilute the seriousness of our circumstances. Some of the guys had a shirt made for the deployment with, quote, "Keep Your Feet 2012," end quote, inscribed on the front, in reference to the high likelihood that one of us would get our legs blown off. Dark humor really is the best humor. And it is terribly necessary in a place as unfunny as Afghanistan, with its long history of destructive conflict. Kandahar Province has been a seat of war for the past 3,000 years. The eponymous city of Kandahar itself was an Iron Age fortress. Centuries later, it served as a garrison town of Alexander the Great, who named it after himself. If you list the nations that have fought in, around, and over Kandahar, you get a list of many of the great powers of Europe and Asia across the ages. Greeks, Macedonians, Afghans of all stripes, Persians, Sikhs, Russians, Britons, and Americans. We've all come, fought, and bled in this place where an infinite number of tribal afflictions and familial conflicts spread across the region. Within these small subgroups, loyalty runs deep. In this culture, the slightest insult is met with fatal retribution, and enmities are passed down through generations, never forgotten. Behind the eyes of every Afghan live thousands of years of blood feuds and tragedy. Their history resides deep within. I noticed, especially in the rural outskirts, that the Afghan gaze was never bright and optimistic, but piercing and unsurprised. as if they had witnessed history 100 times over. Their knowledge of the modern world was practically non-existent, and yet their eyes revealed a sort of hardened wisdom. Their movements were slow and even careless, as if they understood that their existence was but a fleeting moment in the dustbin of history. Laughter was rare, and our American joviality was popular only with the children. Perhaps it was nihilism they exhibited. It would be understandable, given that their circumstances could be described by Western standards as utterly hopeless. But that wasn't quite the right explanation for what I saw. What I saw felt more like perspective. And it struck me how fundamentally different, down to the bone, the Afghan perspective was. These people were hard, able to endure suffering that a typical American would never dream of. I recall on various operations, conducted in the deep cold of January, that Afghans we encountered would look relatively comfortable in sandals and a thick blanket thrown over their shoulders, not much different from their wardrobe in the spring or summer. The biting cold didn't faze them. Punishment was part of their routine. Being a sixth-generation Texan, I can relate to the sentiment that history lives within you. My ancestors' history gives me perspective when I want to complain about the Wi-Fi on a passenger jet being too slow or intermittent. I need only recall that Sarah Howard, my first ancestor to settle in Texas at age 16, had to walk across the frontier for weeks. Drinking water had to be discovered daily. During her travels, she had a run-in with Comanches that resulted in the death of her first husband. She remarried, and her new husband was killed in similar circumstances, as was her infant. She was held captive and miraculously escaped. She remarried again, and here I am, complaining about the Wi-Fi. Perspective is a revealing thing. It's perhaps a lesson we could learn from Afghans and the first Texas settlers. The men we met in Afghanistan, aged in warfare and hardship, never uttered the word microaggression. I believe the women were equally steely-eyed, maybe more so, but their customs prevented us from ever finding out. Only family members are allowed to see women in the rural, deeply traditional areas of Afghanistan where we operated. The children, having not yet come to terms with their hopeless reality, brightened when they spoke of coming to America one day. Frankly, it was heartbreaking. While our own citizens burn our flag or sneer at our Pledge of Allegiance, millions of people around the world would do anything to be here. America is a place of opportunity for individuals willing to seize it. And that fact is still well known around the world, even if our own population is increasingly ignorant of it. Our country consistently ranks as the number one destination for all immigrants when asked where they would go if given a choice. Germany, at second place, isn't even close. The Afghan perspective changed our tactics in combat as well. Fighting in Kandahar required unlearning so much of what we learned and thought we knew about action in combat. The transformative agent of it all was the improvised explosive device, or IED. In my prior deployments to Iraq, I had of course encountered IEDs. They are the ubiquitous tool of the insurgent and the terrorist. Bombs, traps, explosives, set off by command or activation, placing time and distance between the act and the man. An IED, well hidden and well built, maximizes the insurgents' advantages of concealment, surprise, and terrorization, and minimizes our advantages of firepower, communication, and action. It generates stress and fear in unaccustomed and untrained men, and dread in even the most experienced soldiers, sailors, and Marines. Those who have seen combat understand that there is something qualitatively different between a stand-up fight, where a man may be shot but may also shoot back, and an IED, where death comes in an explosion and there is no defense. The roads and byways of Kandahar province were riddled with IEDs in ways I'd never before seen. The bombs, improved by the Taliban with more than a decade of experience plus the expertise of Pakistani and Iranian trainers, were everywhere. And, we came to understand, they were the enemy's main effort. This changed our tactics dramatically. When you take fire on a battlefield, the traditional course of action is to seek cover and do it fast. Bullets are troubling things, and they have the unique ability to force a 200-pound man into as tiny a profile as possible behind the nearest rock or other small object. In the movies, incoming fire sounds like a buzzing mosquito shooting past your ear. But this isn't the right sound. An actual bullet is breaking the sound barrier when it goes past you, creating a physical and audible conical waveform, which sounds like snap or crack. It is an unmistakable sound that requires immediate reaction. If you have air support overhead, call them up. AC-130 gunships are deadly accurate with their 30mm cannons, and they aren't stingy with ammo. But barring overpowering air superiority, a proper response to incoming gunfire typically means returning fire and maneuvering against the enemy. Hold a base of fire to keep their heads down, and send a squad around to the enemy's flank. Run from cover to cover, never staying up more than a few seconds. Know the difference between cover and concealment. A thick mud wall is cover, because it stops bullets. A thick bush in the mud is concealment, and does not stop bullets. See the difference? This isn't your weekend warrior airsoft match. We practice these maneuvers ad nauseum in the SEAL teams, so that when the time comes, we are taking action instead of contemplating a response. In Kandahar province, here's what you did when the snaps came. Nothing. Well, not nothing. We would fire back when appropriate, but we wouldn't take cover. We wouldn't move off our route. We wouldn't seek refuge in an unscouted location, even if mere feet away. We had learned the hard way that nearly all those alternatives were riddled with IEDs. IEDs buried in the street, IEDs concealed in doorways, IEDs along garden walls, IEDs in sheds, IEDs in canals, IEDs in culverts, IEDs in homes, IEDs in houses of worship, IEDs in random hilltops that made no sense at all. On one particular mission, three of our guys hiked up a small hilltop to establish an overwatch position while the platoon cleared through the village below. The hilltop was impossibly remote, even by Afghan standards, a mountainous waste in the middle of nowhere, where neither we nor the Taliban reasonably expected the other to conduct operations. The village was quiet, and we never encountered the enemy. My teammates dug in, and as they prepared their position, a loud bang pierced the air. They had set up atop a large IED, and the blasting cap went off without detonating the main explosive charge. They should have died, but, thanks to Providence and a hasty bomb emplacement, did not. The damn things were everywhere. It was possible to predict, to an extent, the placement of IEDs by professionals or informed amateurs. But the freelancers, locals looking for revenge or just some extra pay, were just anarchic. You didn't know where they would decide a good bomb location would be. A vegetable garden, a bicycle, a window, a garbage pile, a courtyard. All these could be the grotesque welcome mats known as IEDs. On more than one occasion, I watched our Afghan partner force, the Afghan commandos as they were known, fall victim to such horrors. This meant that ordinary tactics went by the wayside. We traveled in single file, which is a crappy tactical formation in normal circumstances, because stepping outside of that could mean death, or at best, not keep your feet 2012. Our whole world shrank to what was cleared and what was not. We worked, patrolled, and fought in this landscape, ranging from Mars-like deserts to pristine river valleys to snow-covered peaks, strewn with bombs hidden at the whim and direction of uncompromising Taliban, fanatical students, and vengeful grape farmers. On June 15, 2012, they got me. During a last-minute emergency mission, we flew out to support a United States Marine Corps Special Operations Unit, better known as MARSOC, operation underway in neighboring Helmand Province. Helmand was every bit as bad as Kandahar. 2 years earlier, a major offensive there, in and around the town of Marja, had sputtered out with a putative coalition victory, but no lasting gains. The MARSOC platoon had already sustained casualties and was running out of ammo and radio batteries after 2 days of fighting. They needed to be tagged out, and higher-ups wanted to maintain a presence in the area. So they volunteered us, also known as voluntold in military jargon. We were happy to join the fight, as I recall. I didn't have any obligation to go on that mission, but I asked to go anyway. Thus, how the small decisions change your life forever. We flew in under cover of darkness. We like to do that for reasons beyond ordinary nighttime surprise. After a decade plus of war, we understood IEDs fairly well. One thing an IED generally needs is power. They require batteries to detonate them if they aren't manned, and most of them weren't. Batteries aren't hard to get out in the world, but in remote rural Afghanistan, they, like most manufactured products, are not to be squandered. When an IED was not imminently needed, the Taliban would disconnect or even remove the battery powering it. If they didn't, if it was kept connected with a bit of current sapping its potency over time, eventually it would run down. Fresh batteries meant functional bombs. Swooping in before dawn meant the enemy would not have the chance to reconnect those disconnected batteries. That was the theory. On June 15, 2012, it was wrong. The Marines had been fighting there for days, which meant all the IEDs were connected to their power sources, a sickening array of deadly welcome mats meant to maim their victims, not kill them. We were clearing a mud-walled compound just as daylight appeared above the horizon. There's a beauty to the early morning that most don't get to see. The deep green countryside, with patches of poppy fields throughout, is blanketed with a thick morning mist. The intense humidity permeates your clothing. The smell of fire in the village reminds you of its ancient quality, where not a single modern appliance can be found. Goats and roosters begin stirring as the sun rises. Locals brew strong chai and cook shakshuka, an egg and tomato puree dish. Even in the intensity of a combat operation, it is impossible to miss the undeniable charm of these places. Untouched by modern civilization, captured by ancient tradition and the conflict that accompanies it. In this former home, abandoned after years of warfare by the family who lived there, we poured into the inner courtyard. Our explosive ordnance specialists were still clearing it as best they could with metal detectors, and in hindsight, that clearance should have been more methodical and deliberate. But there is a fine balance between thoroughly clearing a compound for IEDs and forcing the platoon to wait outside, exposed, for extended periods of time. Someone called for my Afghan interpreter, Rahman, a good man with whom we had worked for some time. These interpreters are the unsung heroes of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. They often suffer threats and ostracism for their willingness to endure the battlefield alongside us. Their motivation isn't money. There isn't enough money to make it worthwhile facing down insurgents who know where you and your family live. They are idealists. They work and risk death because they believe in our common cause of freedom. Rahman responded to the call immediately. Running before me, his foot fell on a particular spot just 2 feet away from where I stood. I was looking right at him. As I later discovered, he instantly lost all his limbs in the explosion. Even though I was staring right at him, I never actually saw it happen. My experience was a series of tremendous blows and subsequent realizations. A train hit me. Ears ringing. What the fuck was that? Darkness. Something is wrong. Got hit. My legs. Reach down and see if they're still there. They're there. I feel them. Pain everywhere. Mostly in my abdomen. Something shot through it, I think. My eyes must be caked with mud. I can barely see anything. I hear groaning and screaming. Someone hit an IED. Pain everywhere but my eyes. I crawl around a little bit, mostly to see if my body still functions. My teammates make their way to me. I ask someone to pour water on my eyes to remove the dirt so I can see. It doesn't work. I can only see light and some shapes. Must be a lot of dirt. I recognize my corpsman's voice as he works on my wounds. I say, "Dude, don't get blown up. It sucks." He laughs and tells me to shut up. I was conscious throughout. Our corpsman stopped my bleeding, the worst of which was from my knees, and wrapped up my eyes. It still did not occur to me that there was anything wrong with them. I could only hear the situation around me, my teammates calling to each other, communicating the situation with tense voices. I later found out that a foot, wearing the typical Solomon boot that we all wore, hit one of my teammates in the chest about 50 yards away. Rahman was groaning in pain. Deep, deep pain. Most people's experience of combat wounds is from the movies. A soldier gets hit, his guts spilling out, and he looks down at them screaming in horror. But this is not the way it is. In reality, truly bad injuries sap your energy and prevent you from screaming. Instead, the sound a wounded man makes is much deeper, more visceral, emanating from the depths of his being. It is a groan, a cry, a moaning that reeks of utter desperation. It is far worse than a scream. It is true pain manifested into sound. This was the sound that Rockman made. It is unforgettable. As the corpsman tended to me and we waited for the medevac helicopter, a thought entered my head. We may be in a firefight any second now. Rockman was barely alive, and he would later die in the hospital. Our EOD, or Explosives Ordnance Disposal, chief petty officer took a little frag also and would be evacuated with us. All hands were needed to fight. I could hear the medevac helo coming in low. This was no time to ask someone to carry me. Blown up and blind, I stood up and walked myself to it. Dave Worson, who would be killed 2 months later, heroically laid down cover fire for me as I boarded the helo. It was my last memory of him. Medics on board the helicopter took one look at me, laid me down, and eased me into unconsciousness. I woke up, days later, far away from Helmand, far away from Kandahar, far away from my brothers in arms, far away from the war and dust of Central Asia. I was brought back into consciousness in Germany, at the American hospital at Landstuhl. A breathing tube was being unceremoniously ripped from my throat. Rather unpleasant. I opened my eyes, or thought I did, and saw nothing. A physician came to see me and told me the truth. My right eye was gone. My left eye was so heavily damaged that there was virtually no chance I would see with it again. My future was a future of blindness, of darkness, of no sight, no color, no visual beauty. I would never see a sunset, a friend, a loved one again. In one instant, in a fatal footfall, all that was ripped away. I would never read a book again. I would never see a movie again. I thought about Tara, my fiance, and the chance that I might not see her when we finally got married. Would I be able to remember my loved one's faces? I thought back to another time in my life, 2 decades earlier. First time I ever witnessed the kind of inescapable pain that I was now feeling and the grit to overcome it was with my mother. She fought a battle that so many other modern women fight, breast cancer. And she did so with endurance, grace, and optimism. Her example has never left me, and I wasn't about to let some cheap-ass IED in the ancient killing fields of Afghanistan render me unworthy of her memory. She was only 35 years old when she was diagnosed, same age as me as I read these words. When she got the news, it was 1 day before my little brother's first birthday. I was 5 years old. The doctors told her she might have 5 years to live, and they were right. Soon after, she would be feeling the pain I was feeling now, as the cancer and chemotherapy ripped apart her body in battle. She fought it for 5 years, and when I was 10, she died. If you've ever cared for a loved one in terminal decline, you know what that's like. There's an intensity of loss that is immeasurable. Words don't do it justice. The hole deep down in your gut feels like it will never go away. As a child, the intensity of the experience is made worse as grief is amplified by incomprehension. Going from kindergarten to fourth grade, knowing that your mother is dying, that the center of a small boy's world is collapsing, is an experience I wouldn't wish on anyone. But from this grief came learning. I got to experience the nature of a true hero, and the example she set was the most powerful, fortifying, and selfless thing I have ever seen, including in combat. Lying helpless in a hospital bed, I had to wonder whether my mother had asked the same desperate question I was currently asking. Would I ever see my family again? I figured that if she could suffer through that question and the unknowable answer, so could I. My mother spent half a decade staring death in the face, burdened with caring for 2 small boys whom she would not live to see grow up. She lived day to day in ever-increasing pain. The cancer afflicted her, and the cancer treatments afflicted her. 6 rounds of chemotherapy on top of radiation treatments are a brutal experience for even the strongest constitution. Self-pity is never a useful state, but if anyone had reason to feel sorry for herself and to complain a bit, it was my mom. She never did. In terminal decline and in pain across 5 years, I never heard her complain once. I never heard her bemoan her fate. I never saw her express self-pity. Every day she woke up was a day she was still alive and she lived. She was dying and she was grateful to not be dead yet. Every extra day was a gift where she could look her boys in the face. Every next evening was another night she could tell us she loved us before bed. Even during her last days, when the hospital delivered her deathbed and hospice nurse to our dining room, her demeanor did not change. We played Clue every night. We played with my G.I. Joes. She laughed through the pain and anguish, knowing she had just a few days left. Susan Carol Crenshaw was exactly the opposite of what she had every right to be. Instead of wallowing in victimhood and despair, she was an optimist with a genuine heart and a goofy sense of humor. She told my dad before she died, "You bring any floozy women around my boys and I'll scare the shit out of them." Dark humor is the best kind of humor. Maybe that's where I get it from. A little perspective can be the difference between spiraling into dark despair and clawing your way back to the light. A brave young woman fought through despair 20 years before, which meant I could do it now, suffering in darkness in a sterile hospital room in Germany. So when the doctors told me I had virtually no chance of seeing ever again, I just heard one thing. Virtually. Self-deception and optimism are sometimes indistinguishable. I decided right then that I was going to see again. I still had one eye. I used to have two, but that was twice the number I needed. Whatever it took, I was going to see. But if I was going to see, I needed surgery immediately. I have never been one to believe that you can simply will yourself to miraculous healing. Buried in my ravaged left eye was a sliver of copper, an artifact of the bomb, and it was slowly, surely, inexorably burning out what remained of my retina. Metal is toxic when inside the eye, unsurprisingly. It needed to go. To do that, I would have to be transported again, this time to Walter Reed Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland. It took a couple of days to make it happen. This was where some of the misery set in. I'd been through a serious physical trauma. Awake now in Landstuhl, I could not move. I was beaten and, for the moment, physically broken. I was riddled with shards and debris under the skin and deep within. I was swollen badly, suffering from 1,000 small cuts. Everything burned and itched. Though oddly enough, I don't recall any pain in my eyes. Go figure. The physicians and I fought a lot. I wanted to go to Walter Reed now. Their timelines for action were informed by medical and logistical realities. My timeline was not. I wanted to be stateside in hours, not days. I had an eye to save, damn it. Resignation is not in my nature, much like it was not in my mother's. Two other SEALs, Joe and Ray, had flown with me to Germany to be by my side. Thank God they did. They understood me better than anyone in a hospital could, and they managed my tumultuous relationship with the doctors. They made sure I wasn't going through it alone. And what was it, exactly? I said before that I woke up unable to see. But this was not entirely true. I could not see my surroundings, true, but I was certainly seeing. I was surrounded by constant hallucinations, the result of my optic nerve still communicating erratically with my brain. The hallucinations were lucid and all followed a pattern. I was in Afghanistan. I was with the guys. I was in an Afghan village, mud walls and compounds. There was an Afghan man sitting next to me. There were piles of weapons in the corner. I lived my previous experiences over and over again. I knew it wasn't real. I was hallucinating, but not delusional. If I was awake, I was seeing these images. If I was lucky enough to fall asleep and dream, never more than 30 minutes, then I would wake up still inside the visual reality of the dream. This literal living nightmare would continue unabated for another week. Tara was there when I finally arrived in Bethesda and never left my side from that moment on. Most of my family came up to see me, as did many friends. They were far more worried than I was, and their spirits were low. This was most likely due to the fact that they were mentally coherent enough to sense the pessimistic expectations of my surgeons. The doctors did not think I would see again. They said so many times, and I simply didn't believe them. My optimism, my self-deception, my belief that the coming surgery on my left eye would work and that I would see, was nothing less than a delusional gift that allowed me to keep my sanity. Though I am not one for overt expressions of faith, I will say this. I genuinely believe God's strength was working through me then. He was allowing me to believe something impossible. I prayed and my family prayed and we believed. We believed that military surgeons would pick through a pierced and shrapnel-ridden eye, remove the most minuscule shards and debris, and restore my sight. We did not have good reason to believe it, but we did. Often now, someone will ask me, "What was it like knowing you might never see again?" I tell them, "I don't know." And it's true, I don't. I never believed it. I was in a lot of pain and anguish in that period, but I never believed that. I never believed I was blind for life. I believed I would see again and fully recover, minus one eye. I believed I would return to my platoon and serve a full career as a one-eyed Navy SEAL. The physicians and the surgeons didn't believe it. Yet they did their work and did their best. And as they did, miracles happened there in the operating room. They told me up front what they expected. My lens was destroyed. It still is. I have no lens. My retina was likely to detach. My iris was ruptured. It still is. I can't dilate my pupil as a result. That's why you'll never see me outside without sunglasses. My eye was a mess. My best case scenario was a patch over the right eye and glasses thick as a Coke bottle over the left, which I still wear when not wearing a special contact. Maybe, they thought, I would live a reasonably happy life with vestigial vision, shapes, colors, shadows, that kind of thing. I thought otherwise. I thought I was going to see. The best case scenario was the only scenario. I went into my first surgery with some degree of confidence and an upbeat spirit, despite the fact that I hadn't slept in days and my hallucinations were in full nightmarish swing. Every night, Tara slept by my side. I needed her there for comfort and peace of mind, but also because the hallucinations were so disorienting. They were driving me mad. I was convinced, for instance, that my bed was in the shape of an X. I could only lie diagonally, and because I could never see the bed, I couldn't get reoriented. I remember waking up one night, or maybe a day, from a dream where I was in a sort of third-world department store, full of fluorescent lights and cheap clothing, pushing through racks of disorganized, musty clothes. In the dream, someone might have been chasing me. I had a sense of anxiety, but wasn't sure why. When I woke up, I couldn't escape the dusty, decidedly unfashionable shirts, jackets, and dresses that were all around me. The nightmare was literally inescapable. I was on edge, and Tara was one of the few people I wanted around to dull the pain. I was too irritable to handle small talk, which meant I was too irritable for most people. A couple of my best friends from the teams, Joe and Dave, were also there around the clock to provide support and much-needed comedic relief. One of the first questions they asked me when I arrived in Bethesda was, "So Dan, we can start making fun of you for looking like a pirate for the rest of your life, right?" Never too early for the dark humor of the teams. Two great things happened after my first surgery. They removed the broken lens, the cataract, along with the copper wire and other debris in my eye, and my hallucinations stopped. As I was being wheeled back to my room for recovery, an astutely observant nurse finally asked the question, "How long have these hallucinations been going on?" "The whole time," answered Tara, exhausted from caring for me and watching someone she loved suffer for the past week. "Oh my God," she replied. "He will have irreparable PTSD if we don't stop them." She requested a heavy dose of Ativan, a strong anti-anxiety medication, in the hopes it would make the hallucinations disappear. It worked. But it didn't work immediately. Oddly enough, I still had hallucinations, but they were Christmas-themed hallucinations. Christmas trees, presents, candy canes. It was downright bizarre, and just as crazy as it sounds. After a few hours on the potent drug, everything faded to black. I was finally blind. And it was a relief like you wouldn't imagine. I slept. Within the next few days, I began to recover from surgery and see the shapes and colors around me. I remember the complete and utter relief from my friends and family. We were on the verge of a miracle. And then, a few days later, it all came crashing down again. During a checkup with ophthalmology, they discovered a small hole in my retina, a macular degeneration, in doctor speak. Now, a small hole isn't a big deal since it just creates a small blind spot in your vision. The problem is that hole will keep expanding because of the natural anatomy of your eye until you are totally blind. The surgical fix for this is actually quite simple, but given the fragile state of my eye, doctors were reluctant to open it back up. We were faced with two simple options. One, don't do the surgery and enjoy the limited sight I had for a period of time. See Tara again, see my family again, and then say goodbye as the vision slowly deteriorated to blackness. Or two, do the surgery and risk going blind right away, since there was such a high chance of my retina detaching during surgery. There was virtually no chance I would have a successful surgery. But I have some family history in last-ditch pursuits of medical miracles. My mom died in 1994, after volunteering to be a patient in a clinical trial for an anti-cancer drug known as Taxotere. She didn't qualify for the trial at first, but the lead physician was so impressed with her vitality, positivity, and fight that he sought an exception, and she became patient number one. A local TV station in San Antonio interviewed her about the treatment, and she looked upbeat. "It's been wonderful," she said. "Before, I had no hope. I had gone through all the stages of treatments and there wasn't really anything left. I had no options." She is seen in the news report laughing and relaxed as she undergoes the therapy. There was real risk in this unknown new drug. Side effects and correct dosage were not yet known, but fear and hesitation were not an option. She went for it. The Taxotere worked too well. Rapid remission of tumors in her right lung led to its collapse and several surgeries, during which time the Taxotere was discontinued and the cancer returned, more aggressive than before. She kept fighting as she always had, and she was fighting when she passed. And so the option seemed obvious to all of us. Risk blindness? Yes. Blindness was coming either way. Best to confront it head on, like the image of that old farmer hurling a bottle of cheap whiskey at that incoming tornado. We went for it, and my second miracle happened. But there's a downside to this surgery, even when it is successful. My world went dark again for 6 weeks. This 6-week recovery period was far from ideal, but bearable. I was accustomed to being blind at this point, but I do admit that the trauma of being blind would have been far greater if it was a permanent condition. It is one thing to deal with blindness as a possibility, with some hope that you will see again in a matter of weeks. It is quite another to adapt to blindness knowing that it is your permanent state. I know other veterans who have suffered similar injuries to mine, but lost both eyes. My story pales in comparison to theirs. My story pales in comparison to many other acts of sacrifice and heroism. The great danger for me post-surgery was a detached retina. If that happened, all else would be for naught. It would be blindness, whole and permanent, with no recourse. My eye needed to heal and my retina needed to stay firmly in place. So here's what the doctors do. They place a gas bubble in your eye. The bubble fixes the retina firmly in place, but only if you stay face down for 6 weeks. Face down for 6 weeks, blind and waiting, takes a bit of adaptation. No one is particularly built for it. And I am less so than most. The fact that the whole front side of my body was still sore and riddled with shrapnel wounds didn't make lying face down any more pleasant. It was an enforced helplessness. Even if I could have moved, and I could by then, I didn't dare. Just straightening my neck up or rolling over could be a fatal moment, plunging me into darkness forever. I made certain to heed the doctor's orders and always face the ground. I even borrowed a massage chair, the kind where you place your face down for a back massage, which I sat in all day, listening to audiobook after audiobook. I sat with my thoughts, my family, a very patient and loving Tara, and my white chocolate mocha from Starbucks. Don't judge me, I had a craving for them, couldn't help it. I thought about a lot of things, some of them pleasant, mostly seeing and getting back to my platoon, and some not so pleasant. I was irritable. I probably lashed out way too many times. I sometimes partook in some of the petty outrage that this book indicts. Tara stuck by me anyway. But I never thought about being blind. I took issue with the small stuff. The menial annoyances of daily life were highly amplified for me, perhaps because they were things I could control. But when it came to the truly frightening possibility of blindness or even just permanent visual problems, the thing I could not control, I was silent on the issue. The assumption of eventually recovering my sight in my left eye was unwavering. It was fact, non-negotiable. In a sense, I was able to handle the hard stuff because I let off steam on the small stuff. When the 6 weeks were over, I sat up, and I was not blind. Moreover, with the help of a truly remarkable contact lens from Boston Sight, to which the Navy referred me years later, I was eventually returned to 20/20 correctable vision with my left eye. Without my contact in, I still use Coke bottle lenses to see. I do still have a cataract that can't be totally fixed, but the fact that I can correct my vision to 20/20 is nothing short of a miracle. That's my story of being blown up. I can't say I recommend the experience. Yet, even as it was happening, even in the moment after the blast, I had to admit, could have been worse. I still had my legs. I had my arms. I had 10 fingers and 10 toes. My brain worked, even after the severe concussion. I was still alive. It is impossible not to constantly think of the many veterans who have sacrificed so much more. Impossible not to think of SEAL Petty Officer Second Class Mike Mansour, who threw himself on a grenade while on a rooftop in Ramadi, Iraq in 2006, saving his teammates. Impossible not to think of Air Force Master Sergeant John Chapman, who fought all night against the Taliban, coming in and out of consciousness from his wounds, eventually succumbing to them on that Afghan ridgeline, but only after earning the